the Lord of Flies.
We have met. So you spoke the truth, proud Lord of Flies. Hell is now a triumvirate.
No, no. It's a triumvirate.
Three kings in darkness. I am Azazel. Welcome, Dream King.
Azazel, welcome.
The third Lord of Hell.
I am he.
A fallen angel, like Lucifer, Azazel hovers, a floating absence, a black amoebic nothingness filled with myriad eyes and mouths.
Some years ago, the Dark, a shadow creature accompanied by an army of shadow demons, came forth to challenge heaven.
I know nothing of it. I have been a captive.
The episode ended in, perhaps a stalemate. But the civil war in hell that ensued tipped the precarious balance of power. We rule in coalition now. Azazel, Beelzebub, and I.
Hell a triumvirate. Things change indeed. Very well. I seek a demon who has stolen my helm of office. I wish it back.
Which demon, then? Name them, and we will bring them here.
There are more than a million demons, after all.
I do not know the demon's name.
Then let us summon all of them to tell, and meet them on the vasty plains of hell.
The physical manifestation of hell encompasses a landscape as varied as its demonic inhabitants. There are mountains, ice caves, swamps of lava, rivers of blood, and deserts where fire rains upon the damned. There are plains of ice, hail, snow, and here of wind. This wide, flat, rocky wilderness is where Lucifer has assembled his unspeakable cohort of demonry. From a promontory of rock where Lucifer, Beelzebub, and Azazel have brought him, Morpheus surveys 10 million spirits, living nightmares only glimpsed in his realm of dreams. Among them are incubi, succubi, and goblins. There are cambions, familiars, and druids. There are demons of fate, tempters, false spirits, and vessels of iniquity. There are nameless ones, and there are demons who fell with Lucifer on the first day. Some are repulsive to gaze upon. Some are comely. None can be trusted.
There. Now, Dream King, tell us, which demon has your helmet?
I look at the demons. Some I recognize from nightmares. Others have traveled through the dreaming in the past. But there are so many. One of you has my helm. My mask of pure dream. I crafted it myself from the bones of a dead god. It is one of my tools. Well?
None will admit it.
Then I must find another way.
Dream takes the pouch from his robe and pours out a measure of sand. He blows the dust from his outstretched palm. It swirls up over the assembled horde like smoke. Then it swirls and coalesces into a spinning pillar, arrowing down into the mob, which draws away, leaving a single figure standing alone.
Ah.
The figure is human in its disposition of body and limbs, but the head is elongated, and the ears, like the teeth and its two mouths, pointed.
That one.
Corinzon, a Duke of Hell, one of Beelzebub's. Well, Corinzon, does Dream speak truly? Do you indeed have his mask of office?
What if I have?
You may not talk to us that way, Corinzon. Have you the helmet?
Yes, Lord.
Return it to me. Now.
I traded it from a mortal for a paltry thing. But it was a fair trade. He asked the protection of the Lord of Flies.
You bargained with a mortal in Beelzebub's name?
Corinzon is one of my captains.
But it was a fair trade. I have broken none of the laws of hell.
You have my helm.
You want your precious back? Then you must fight me for it. Do I hear a challenge?
Dream does not know if he is strong enough yet to prevail in a battle of wits. Truly, he does not. But he has come so far and has so much to rebuild.
Very well. Yes, I challenge you, Corazon.
So, as the challenged one, I choose the battlefield. I assert reality.
The demonic realm is whisked away, immediately replaced by something equally disturbing. Dream finds himself seated at a table in a damp basement. It is a nightclub. Set into the peeling black-painted walls is alcove seating. There is a bar at one side, a low wooden stage with two microphones and other small round tables on the floor of the club with drinks on them. Around the room, tuxedoed male and finely dressed female demons await their evening's entertainment. Many are grotesque parodies of humankind. Others are simply monstrous. Among them Lucifer, Beelzebub, and Azazel. One client calmly picks the flesh off his partner's face and eats it. Her acquiescent, loving expression is slowly reduced to a raw, bleeding skull.
To another thrill-packed evening of fun here at the Hellfire Club. I am your host, Corazon, High Duke of the Eighth Circle, Captain of the Horde of Lord Beelzebub. Tonight, for your entertainment and delectation, a formal challenge.
It has been a long time since Dream was forced to play such games with demons. He rises, slowly approaching the stage. The Hellfire Club. It feels like a bad joke. And, like everything else in Hell, it is deadly serious.
As the challenged, I set the meter and take the first move. And the challenger is Dream. Once the master of the realm of sleep. So let's have a big hand for Morpheus of the Endless. That's your microphone.
I see.
You know the rules, Dreamlord. If you win, I will return your helmet. If you lose, you will serve as a plaything of hell for eternity. Our slave.
I understand.
Very well. I have the first move. I am a dire wolf, prey-stalking, lethal prowler.
A ghostly shadow play wolf pads around Morpheus on the stage. He sees it, but still smells spilt alcohol, stale smoke, and cheap sex, perfume, and mold.
My move. I am a hunter. Horse-mounted wolf stabbing.
Now he can also feel the grass beneath his hooves, the flanks between his legs. All is real. Nothing is real. And it is Corazon's move.
I am a horsefly, horse-stinging, hunter-throwing.
There are many ways to lose the oldest game. Failure of nerve, hesitation, being unable to shift into a defensive shape, lack of imagination. Dream must think quickly.
I am a spider, fly-consuming, eight-legged.
I am a snake, spider-devouring, poison-toothed.
I am an ox snake, crushing, heavy-footed.
He feels the snake writhe beneath his hoof, its spine crushed.
I am anthrax, butcher-bacteria. Tyrium. Warm life destroying.
A change in direction, but still an old gambit.
I think I understand how Corazon plays, how I can turn it against him.
Dream is distracted by a small child standing at Beelzebub's table, holding a tray of dainties, human organs and genitalia, from which the Lord of Flies selects, then eats. Then he sees there are bottles behind the bar, glimpses labels saying Old Kentucky Souls, lymphatic fluid, waters of Lethe. But Morpheus must concentrate. He decides to abandon the offensive.
I am a world, space floating, life nurturing.
Lucifer's glass pauses on its journey to his lips. The stolen helmet, a badge of office for the Lord of Dreams, is of no use in hell, merely an artifact. But it served to lure a weakened Morpheus here into a game of riddles, and was, until this moment, the best chance of trapping him in hell.
I am a Nova! All exploding, planet cremating.
I am a universe, all things encompassing, all life embracing.
I am the anti-life, the beast of judgment. I am the dark at the end of everything, the end of universes, gods, worlds, of everything. What will you be then, Dream Lord?
I am hope.
And Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, tells Corazon what he is. The one thing that hell cannot kill or destroy. The one thing they had all forgotten.
I am hope.
Oh. Well, then I am...
I don't know.
I don't know!
The nightclub has gone. The plane of hell, with all its demons, surround Dream once more. Lucifer steps forward, glaring down at the cowering figure of Corazon.
Where are the twins? Where are Agony and Ecstasy?
The slave twins of the Inquisition of Hell, bound together with barbed wire, step forward.
We hear and obey, Lord.
Take this pathetic creature from our sight. Demonstrate to him our displeasure.
No, not this!
They bind Corazon with the wire and bear him away.
Lord, he said, protect me!
So, it is over.
Here, Dream Master. This is your helmet. You have won it. Barely. Take it.
I thank you. The kings of hell are honorable. I will remember this.
Honorable? You joke, surely. Look around you, Morpheus. The million lords of hell stand arrayed about you. Tell us why we should let you leave. Helmet or no, you have no power here. What power have dreams in hell?
You say I have no power. Perhaps you speak truly. But you say that dreams have no power here. Tell me, Lucifer Morningstar, ask yourselves, all of you, what power would hell have if those here imprisoned were not able to dream of heaven?
Silently, they move aside, unable to meet his gaze. Walking steadily, his helmet by his side, the Lord of Dreams takes his leave of hell. His hopes fulfilled.
I'll destroy him.
Arkham Asylum for the Criminally Insane, Gotham City, April the 1st, 1:45 a.m.
Hey, D.
Maximum security.
Dr. Destiny, whatever your name is. You awake?
Always.
Day shift should have brought you this.
Huh?
But they, told you, right?
Why?
Oh. Dr. Huntoon said to tell you your mother's croaked. She's dead.
Mother?
She wanted you to have this. Catch.
Thank you, Mother. It's just what I always wanted.
Seriously. An eyeball on a bracelet.
An amulet. Do you want to see how it works? Come closer to the bars.
The Sandman. Passengers.
Arkham Asylum is never quiet at night. The best the night security team can do to block out the distant screaming is to take turns off duty at the security station, watching whatever TV is available.
All you late night Gothamites.
Good evening, fellow tourists. I think this proves that in some ways the airplane can never replace the train.
Hey, Johnson. You on your own?
Yeah, Bracken's doing the 2 a.m. perimeter.
Where's Hume?
Dr. D got something in the mail. Day shift forgot to take it down, so Hume did.
Gifts have to be cleared with Huntoon.
Yeah, it was just a weird piece of jewelry, man. An eyeball or something.
Either way, Hume shouldn't go down there on his own. Can you see anything on the monitors?
Nah, all quiet.
I'll go down. Take a look in on D anyway.
Take a radio.
Copy that.
John Dee, once known as the criminal scientist Dr. Destiny, wasn't always a criminal. But his genius led him to create the Materiopticon, a device which allowed him to create reality from the fabric of dreams. This, powered by the ruby his mother gave him, stolen from the Lord of Dreams, pushed him over the edge. Now he creeps, almost bent double, past the security station, his footfalls covered by the sound of the TV set. It helps that his feet are bare. So is the rest of him. This is his preferred condition, since he was captured and interred at Arkham by the Justice League International. In one disfigured hand, he clutches a handgun, worn until a while ago by the late and unfortunate security guard, Hume. In the other, for protection, the eyeball amulet his mother, Ethel Cripps, also purloined from the collection of her lover, Ruth Van Sykes, who in turn was given it by the demon Beelzebub.
Yeah, what's on Channel 6?
Easy now. The dining hall has the window with the broken catch. Easy.
Hume? Bracken?
Quietly through. God, God.
Huh? Surprise! It's only me.
Dr. Crane. Jonathan.
Now, don't tell anybody else about this.
You're hanging yourself?
There's nothing like a good hanging to scare people witless. Fear of pain is algophobia. I don't know what fear of hanging is called. But when they come, I'll stick out my tongue and I'll be white as a sheet and they'll all look up at me hanging here and then I'll go, April Fool.
Oh, very well.
You're the doctor, aren't you? Some people are afraid of doctors. It's called iatrophobia. Dr. Destiny. Yes. Aren't you meant to be locked up downstairs?
Shh. You mustn't tell anyone. I'm escaping. My mother died.
Oh.
She gave me her amulet. It keeps people safe from things. She told me that. She gave me my ruby, too. But now she's dead. Shall I tell you what I'm going to do?
Oh, tell me. Tell me.
I'm going to get the ruby back. The materiopticon. And then I'll drive everybody in the whole wide world mad, and then they'll make me king.
It sounds scary. Have a nice time. And you must promise when you get back to tell me all about it.
You don't understand. I'm going to rule the world. Or destroy it. I'm not coming back.
Yes, yes. But we always come back here. It's so scary outside. If you see the Joker, tell him to hurry back. It isn't April Fool's Day without his little jokes. But I'm doing my best. I left another over there.
Yes, I see it. It's very funny. You hung Mr. Bracken up, too, with a sign saying, kick me. But he is dead. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's 3 a.m. on Arkham Island. In the distance, the lights of the Trigate Bridge are reflected in the waters of the Mirgani Channel. Dr. D drops from the window with the broken catch and moves across the yard to the security fencing. He climbs it with ease. The razor wire at its top doesn't hurt him. The amulet protects him from harm. He's now on the road leading to the island's medical facility. A car is approaching with what looks like a woman at the wheel. Probably a nurse arriving for the graveyard shift. Dee steps into the road. He levels the pistol at the oncoming car. It slows to a halt.
Unlock the passenger door!
Don't hurt me!
Turn off the music. Hello.
What do you want?
I'm going to find my ruby. You're gonna drive me. I'll tell you where to stop. Turn the car around. Go back over the westward bridge.
But I...
Trust me. I'm a doctor.
As the car speeds into the night, darkness falls once more. From Gotham to Manhattan, people are asleep. Millions move through their particular scaries of the dreaming. One of them is a Justice League agent, a successor to those who tracked down Dr. Destiny and brought him to Arkham. Although he now resides in New York City, he was born the son of Isaiah Highfather, the ruler of the world New Genesis. But his childhood was spent as a hostage of Highfather's nemesis, Darkseid, the tyrant of New Apocalypse, and he was raised in the terror orphanage of Granny Goodness. Each night he dreams he is a child again, escaping her clutches.
I flee past gray borders, down the darkling road to long shadows. I skirt the fire pits and lose myself in the heart of the Armageddon. But it doesn't matter where I go. All roads lead back to Granny.
Happiness is the heart that's Granny's. Rip out your heart for Granny. Granny loves you.
Granny loves me. so she has them bind me in chains, encase my feet in concrete. She wraps me tight in her love and her voice, ties me tight with steel and granite. I've been a bad little boy. I said a bad thing. I left her. And this is what they do to bad little boys. They put them in the murder machine.
What?
I leave the coffin behind me. I sidestep the knives, leap through the flames. The bomb explodes, but I am not where I was. The floor vanishes. I do not fall into the acid pit. I reach the womb, the exit, the box. It's the last trap. Somehow I know that. The last exit. All I have to do is type my name, my real name, my true name, and the door will open, and I will be scot-free.
Let you go.
My friends Zepp and Bravo and Weldon hang here in warning. Lowlies who never escaped the Armageddon. The black blood of a bygone decade crusted on their necks. Aurelie hangs there. Sweet Aurelie, my first love. Her feet burned away and her eyes churning with maggots.
What do I call you? Scot Free?
Not Scot Free. Scot Free was just Granny's joke.
What is your name, my love?
I don't know my name!
And now I'm gonna die. I'm falling into the pit. The blade's pointing upward, waiting for me.
It's over, child. I have caught you. You can wake up now.
I open my eyes on a strange room. And for a moment, I don't know where I am. The disorientation passes. It is a bedroom in the JLI Embassy in Manhattan. A long way from apocalypse. It was only a dream. But if it was only a dream... What are you doing here?
Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, stands at the foot of the bed.
Who are you?
I am a friend. You are seeking your true name, Scot Free. And I have come to reclaim something of mine. A ruby.
Turn left here.
Listen, Buster. I'm warning you. You lay a finger on me, I'll... So help me, you try anything. My husband's a mafia hitman. He'll kill you, so don't even think it. Don't... Oh, God. Don't kill me.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. It's just that... Sorry.
You, escaping from prison?
No. From Arkham. The madhouse?
Oh, Jesus.
My mother died last week. She was very old. That was when I knew I had to get away from that place.
Oh, I'm sorry. Say, why aren't you, you know, wearing anything?
They took my clothes away. They were scared I'd kill myself. Hang myself with a shirt, perhaps.
Aren't you cold?
Yes, very cold.
Well, there's an old coat of Harry's... My husband's in the back. Why don't you put it on? You must be freezing.
A coat? That's very nice of you. I'd like to wear a coat. Thank you.
In the Justice League Operations Center, Scott brings up archive files in the JLI computer.
Okay, I think we found your ruby. Should be up on screens any second. Here you go. Taken from some psycho calling himself Dr. Destiny. He was using it to affect people's dreams, make nightmares real, that kind of thing. It was kept in the trophy room on the satellite.
Where is this satellite?
It's space junk. Destroyed.
And my ruby?
It could have been destroyed. Could have been moved to the Detroit Fortress or the Secret Sanctuary or...
You don't know?
Not a clue.
Somebody must know.
Yeah. Is this kind of thing going to happen every time I stay here overnight? No, don't answer that. Let me see. Batman? Nah, it's 3:30 a.m. He'll be at work.
Who else was in the old jail? Oh, got it! Let's go wake him up.
What's your name?
Rosemary.
Rosemary? That's for remembering.
So, what should I call you?
I used to call myself Destiny, Dr. Destiny. It wasn't my name. My mother called me John. Johnny boy, dream boy. I was a real doctor, not a medical one, a scientist one. Now, I'm just Dr. D, Dr. John D.
John, I've got some sandwiches and a lunch pail behind my seat if you're hungry.
No, thank you. I'm never very hungry anymore.
Look, John, I'm a nurse. You can tell me. I won't freak. Is it the big A?
Big A?
AIDS.
Helpers?
AIDS, you know, the disease. Is that why you look like you do? Where have you been for the last 5 years?
Locked up, in darkness, in a maximum security cell in the basement of Arkham.
Oh, I should have... I'm sorry.
They put me there and they forgot about me.
John, who's this they you keep talking about? The police? Did you kill people?
No. I did foolish things. Things to gravity, to identity. I traded their faces with their enemies. I pretended I was of their number.
Who, John?
The costumes, the heroes, the Justice League of America.
I remember them. They've changed now. They're international with, you know, embassies and stuff. Now I think they're called the JLI.
As you say. It was a long time ago.
He might be asleep.
He's not asleep.
Scott, do you know what time it is? I hope this is important.
Yeah, sorry. I know it's nearly four, John, but you're the only member of the old JLA who's still around. We've got a visitor.
Good morning.
You, Lord Lazoro, I greet you humbly.
John Johns, the Justice League of America's Martian Manhunter, drops to his knees upon sight of the Lord of Dreams, whose name and appearance change according to the beholder. To John, Morpheus appears as the great fiery Martian deity, Lord Lazoro, because any possible name for any dream god will attach itself to dream. But in truth, none of them, not even Morpheus, are his names. Dream is not a name. It is a function. None of the Endless truly have names.
And protect us in dreams and from the flame of your wrath.
A Martian? I thought your kind were eons gone.
I am the last of my race.
I seek my Dreamstone, a ruby, last Martian. It was known to your kind as D'Orala, the Stone of Binding. It was taken from a human and kept as a souvenir. Where is it now?
What happened to the old JLA's trophies, John?
That stuff? It's in storage. I thought it would be good to put it on display somewhere, but it's kind of hokey.
Where?
A warehouse, upstate Gotham. Little town called Mayhew. I can get you the exact address.
There is no need. I thank you, last Martian. If you wish, you may dream of the city of Focative Mirrors.
Thank you, Lord Lazoro.
I thank you both. And I hope you find your name scot-free.
Thanks.
Good night.
Who was that?
An old god. A very old god. Come, Scott-Free. Let us hit the kitchen. I have a secret stash of Oreos of which you are welcome to partake.
Mother said, if you are going to be a criminal, John, you are not going to bring shame on the family name. I had to change it. I called myself Destiny. D is for destiny. Now Mother's dead, it doesn't matter anymore. Now I can be D again. D is for lots of things. Death, dust, darkness, demons.
Yeah, well, speaking as a mother of two little girls, John, if either of them announced they wanted to be master criminals, I'd tell them to change their names. Make a change from telling Amy and Jesse to tidy up their rooms, I suppose.
I'm not a black magician.
I didn't say you were, John.
I know, not you, the others, scientists. I'm an hermetic philosopher. And a scientist, too, truly. If I wasn't a scientist, I couldn't have done what I did to the ruby. Do you know what dreams are made of, Rosemary Kelly?
Made of? They're just dreams.
No, they aren't. People think dreams aren't real because they aren't made of matter, of particles. Dreams are real. But they are made of viewpoints, of images, of memories and puns and lost hopes. The ruby seems to turn them into matter. It forces them to translate themselves into forms we can recognize in this world. It also controls dreams in their raw state. Your dreams, anybody's dreams. I don't know where Mother got the ruby from. She had a lucky charm as well. She wouldn't give me that. Not while she lived. I built machines that the ruby powered. Then I built the machines in my dreams. But they stopped me dreaming. So I had to use the ruby directly. I coded circuitry into its clasp. I changed its resonance. I irradiated it. I forced flaws. I isolated it from its original power source. Whatever or whoever that was, I made it more real. I changed it. It isn't a ruby, really. It's a solid dream. It's the only dream I have. Nobody else can use it anymore. Nobody but me. And we're close to it now. I want to drink its light. To drink the light of my ruby.
That signpost just said Mayhew 5 miles.
Huh?
Is that where we're going?
I am a passenger. I am moving through your dreams, all your dreams. I am riding in your dreams. I ride on Dragonback from Manhattan. The dragon is made of riveted iron and smells of cotton candy. I travel briefly by bus, where this dreamer copulates desperately, not noticing his autonomous passenger. I sit at the front, by the driver. His head is a pumpkin. He smokes a cigar. I know him. Approaching the state of Delaware, the dreamer is a small dog, dreaming impatiently of a past life, long forgotten, when he sailed tall ships across uncharted seas. The salt spray of the ocean stings my face. I am moving through dreams, pulling toward the town of Mayhew, feeling for my stolen jewel. Through your dreams, my sleeping children, you had a passenger and you never knew.
Hello? Somebody here? Hey!
I am here.
Oh, okay, mister. It's a little early in the year for trick-or-treat.
Is this the only storage facility in Mayhew?
Sure is. What's in the bag?
Sleep.
The warehouse is clean and well kept, as befits a storage facility devoted to artifacts collected by the Justice League of America, many of them lethal. Dream walks into a maze of anonymous packing cases, punctuated by larger curiosities, a pipe organ, a decommissioned android, a giant playing card with a Joker's head upon it, huge keyholes, an ancient totem pole, and a collection of innocent-looking umbrellas. He is drawn forward by an impulse which brings him to a packing case at the rear of the facility.
Yeah.
Resting inside on a bed of straw is a ruby, the Dreamstone.
At last. Here you are.
But the power of the Dreamstone has somehow altered. What should be a familiar and welcome surge of energy, restoring the Lord of Dreams to his full potential, is draining him instead. Drained of the modest life force which has sustained him since his escape, Dream slumps to the floor. Curled in a fetal position.
Could this be right? There's a guard over there.
He's asleep.
You're right.
Yes. I'm sure this is the place.
Okay, John. Listen, I hope it all goes okay, you know? John, keep the coat. Harry won't mind, and I'd hate to think of you wandering around freezing. And get help, okay?
Thank you, Rosemary. Rosemary, your husband, Harry, is he really a mafia hitman?
Harry? God, no. It was just something I said when I was, you know, scared you were a dangerous crazy or something. Harry's a high school teacher.
Oh. Well, I don't suppose it would have made any difference either way.
Dr. D enters the warehouse. He sees a dark shape lying at the far end of a canyon of packing cases. Beside it, something glowing red. He picks up the Dreamstone.
Hello, my baby. Did this naughty man try to use my baby? He didn't know that you were mine these days. Oh, mine, every glint and facet.
Leaving Dream's unconscious body in the warehouse, Dr. D carries the ruby back outside.
Noisy. Oh, baby, you feel even more powerful than before. Where did the extra energy come from? Have you been fickle? Have you been with someone else? It doesn't matter, darling. We're together again. That's all that counts.
He walks down the road, carrying the Dreamstone toward the lights of a narrow strip of commercial properties which comprises downtown Mayhew.
So go, my little love. Touch the world. Eat their hearts and poison their dreams. Rip their nightmares into the daylight and scum their sleep with creeping fear.
Only the lights in Mayhew's all-night diner are on.
Huh? Ah, yes.
Hello, miss. I would like a cup of coffee while I wait.
Sure, hon. That'll be 50 cents. What are you waiting for?
Oh, you know, the usual. The end of the world.
Last night's rain seems to be clearing. Now we're looking at a more subtle picture over Delaware here on WDPB, with a mild southwesterly blowing the heavy cloud away. Lot more sunshine.
Mayhew, Delaware. It's mid-morning at the all-night diner.
The Sandman. 24 hours.
Hour one. The flies walked into the web.
Betty, can I have a coffee refill and a tuna on rye?
Sure, hon. Coming right up.
Betty Munro is the waitress. Early middle-aged, blonde hair going gray, a little overweight. On her days off, after she's tidied the house, Betty writes stories. She writes them in longhand, on yellow legal pads. Sometimes she writes about her ex-husband, Bernard, and about her son, Bernard Jr., who went off to college and never came back to her. She makes these stories end happily. Most of her stories, however, are about her customers. They look at her, and they just see a waitress. They don't know she's nursing a secret that keeps her aching calf muscles and her coffee-scalded fingers and her weariness from dragging her down. It's her secret. She's never shown anyone her stories. One day she knows she'll package the pads up, bind them in brown paper, send them to Dear Abby or Jackie Collins.
One tuna on rye and a coffee. There.
Thanks.
They'll read them and they'll publish them and everyone will marvel at her depiction of happy, happy small town life. But you're a writer, Johnny Carson will say to her. How do you know what it's like to be a waitress? She'll smile. She won't tell him. It'll be her secret. People think Betty talks to them so easily because she's a waitress. They don't realize she's a writer, gathering material.
Betty, I'm going to use the bathroom. If Donna comes by, tell her to wait, okay?
Sure, Judy.
Judy Talbot. 19, maybe 20. Mixed ethnicity. A leather biker jacket covered in political badges. Attractive to boys, but prefers to be with girls.
Ma'am? Ma'am, could I trouble you for more coffee over here, if you please?
No trouble at all, hon. It's not yet 11. You still got an hour to kill.
Yeah, I know.
The young man, reading the paper now, Mark Brewer, he'd spoken to her easy as anything, just as if he was really talking to a waitress. Tell them you're a writer and they shut up tighter than clams. Mark looks to be early 20s, fair-haired, clean-cut, friendly. He's wearing a suit because he's going for an interview with that big chemical works. Maybe tonight Betty will write a story about him. He'll get the job. Marry the boss's daughter.
I said it's all meringue and razor blades, and she said,
Mr. and Mrs. Fletcher, welcome. Take a load off.
Cheeseburger, black coffee, please, Betty. You, Kate?
I'll have a salad, low-cal dressing. Oh, and a Sanka with low-fat milk, if you have it.
Uh-huh. I'll have to see.
Now that couple, the Fletchers. Gary's big, a little overweight, too. He does karate and collects old weapons. Kate comes from money. She's so smart, so alert. She's petite. Not so much pretty, but attractive. Town talk has it Gary married her for her money, but Betty can see they dote on each other. Like lovebirds. Take one lovebird away, the other hankers and dies. All Betty's stories have happy endings. That's because she knows where to stop. She's realized the real problem with stories. If you keep them going long enough, they always end in death.
Hey, Betty, when you're ready.
With you soon, Marsh.
Sure.
Marsh Janowski sits on a stool at the counter and lights up a smoke. He's thin, and his overalls are dirty. Maybe he didn't learn too much from spending 5 years in the prison laundry. He's not overly smart.
Here you go, Gary. Kate.
Oh, thank you, Betty.
That looks delicious.
Refill, hon?
Betty already knows Judy's story, that she's in love with her friend Donna, who sometimes calls herself Foxglove. Now she notices the bruise on Judy's face. The relationship isn't going too well. Betty isn't small-minded. A writer can't afford to be. What those girls do is a sin against God and unnatural, but still. Betty feels sorry for them. In her stories, she's already married both of them off to fine young men. Like that one, over there.
There you go, Marsh.
Yeah, that's good.
Betty's sort of looked after Marsh since Marsha died. Marsh and Marsha, the writer in her whispers, they were obviously meant for each other. But Marsha drank herself to death, died yellow and whispering in a sanitarium. Marsh, he went sort of crazy after that. A good mailman gone bad. State pen, stealing from the mails. 5 years. He's a trucker these days, working out of some upstate town that had never heard of him. But he still looks in on her every few weeks. For old time's sake.
When do you get off, honey?
You know, Marsh, not until after lunch.
It's okay, I'll wait.
They aren't just customers. Not just to Betty, either. In the far corner of the diner sits John Dee, once the self-styled Dr. Destiny. His skin is shrunken and stretched over his skull. He looks mummified, a few strands of hair still cling to his scalp. A few of his teeth are missing. His eyes are huge, almost lidless balls set deep in their sockets. He's small, practically naked, except for a huge leather sheepskin-trimmed coat made for someone much bigger than he is. In the first hour, he waited and watched. The cold fire in the heart of the ruby whispers to him, as it whispers to the rest of the world, songs of madness and despair. And while it is whispered, the insects crawl in slowly, in ones and twos, into his web. They aren't just customers. They are raw material.
More coffee, hon?
Hmm? I've still got this one. Thank you.
He's been here since Betty came on shift this morning, nursing coffee after coffee, hardly drinking at all, just watching them cool. Away in a dream world of his own, staring at those things lying on the table in front of him. She wonders about him. The red stone on its chain. And the other thing, the eyeball thing. Is that jewelry? She'll talk to him when things get quieter, draw him out. Then tonight, when Marsh has climbed back in his truck and headed back upstate, she'll write a story about him. And in her story, she'll make him happy. Hour two. He is forced to act to prevent any of the flies from leaving. Now he has the ruby back in his possession. It isn't hard.
I don't believe it! I'm going to be late for my interview! Jesus H! Oh, no. Ma'am, I'm leaving $5 on the table here. That should cover it. I'm sorry. Oh, shoot. If I run, maybe I can still make it.
Mark, the young man with the job interview, hesitates. Beyond him, unnoticed in the corner, Dr. D's face is bathed in a red glow. His big round eyes gaze at the young man. Mark stops. His mind has gone blank.
Oh, gosh. Oh, heck. Ma'am, more coffee if it's no trouble?
Sure. Right, coffee.
Great coffee.
Hour three. Afternoon soap opera.
Please, I would like to watch the television. Will you make it work?
You want the TV back on? No problem.
Donna still has not turned up. Judy is on the payphone by the restrooms. She is growing agitated.
Hello? Mrs. Walker. Okay, Miranda. Can I speak to Rose? Thank you. Rose, it's Judy. Listen, have you seen Donna today? Well, we had a fight last night, and I'm sort of worried. She's not answering her phone. Split up? No, of course we haven't. It's just her mom. You think she might have gone back to her mom? Shit. Hello? Mrs. Kavanaugh? This is Judy, Donna's friend. Have you seen Donna today? You don't have to approve of me, Mrs. Kavanaugh, but I just want to... Mrs. Kavanaugh? Hello? Tight-ass old hag! Sorry. I wish I were dead. Damn it.
Hour 4. He watches television. A puppet show.
Look, everyone! It's Dino the Dinosaur! Yay! Hey, kids! Dino's trying to tell me something. Gee, Dino! I didn't know...
Dr. D has never tried to send the power of the ruby into someone's mind at such a distance.
And you want to tell me something else, do you, Dino? We're all gonna die! Dino says... We're all gonna die. Dino told me. He says we should slash our wrists right now. Well, Uncle Bill has his pocket knife somewhere down here. Here it is.
We apologize for interrupting Uncle Bill's playhouse. This is due to technical difficulties. Please stand by.
Hour 5, the flies get restless.
Gary?
I'm saying it's weird. Nobody's come in. It seems like we must have been here for hours. But it seems like we just came in. Something's very... I love this place.
Me too. Anyway, I had these horrible dreams this morning. Horrible.
The entertainer, Uncle Bill, who appears with the puppet Dino the Dinosaur, is in a stable condition. Now, back to those riots, Rick.
Hour 6. Judy is writing a letter on the legal pad she keeps in her bag. It is her fourth attempt.
Dear Donna, I don't blame you for all you said about us last night, and I said I was sorry after I hit you, and I am sorry. Damn it!
I'm saying it's weird. Nobody's come in. It seems like we must have been...
Donna, I love you. I only hurt you because I was scared of losing you. I'm sorry.
Putting you through to the executive director now.
Hour 7. He makes them feel good. He makes their dreams come true. Gives them what they want.
Steve? Yeah, I'm good. I know, 3 years ago I was stuck in a diner waiting for the mailroom job interview. Not a bad career path since. Yeah, so, next. It's an interesting platform.
Mark is running a blue chip electronics corporation.
Have your people call my people. Money.
In his dreams.
Yeah.
And Gary's having a $20 hooker in the convertible Kate bought for him. Then he'll beat the woman up, throw her out of the car, drive off. He gets such a kick out of doing that.
Do it, bitch.
Kate, beside him, doesn't hear him. Kate is in the mortuary of a funeral home, carrying a stainless steel tray with Gary's severed head upon it. She knows she'll never have to worry about Gary's little infidelities again.
This is better.
No more lipstick on his collar. He's all hers. She puts her tongue in his open mouth. Hour 8. John D. moves among them, experiencing their little pleasures, the minor joys.
Bill and Steve Ballmer will have to postpone that meeting.
Pathetic.
I kiss your dead gray lips.
Oh, yeah.
Lousy cheap whore. Lucky I didn't strangle you with it.
Yes.
The Dreamstone whispers to him of elsewhere pains and faraway madnesses, of far-off deaths and distant terrors. This comforts him. He feels echoes of their dreams. Betty has dislodged Stephen King from the bestseller lists.
Oh, really, Oprah? I always dreamed it was possible,
but... It does little for him.
Sad.
Simple pleasures no longer excite him.
Oh, honey, I'm so sorry. Oh, don't stop.
Oh.
Judy's bittersweet reunion with Donna provides fractionally more stimulation for him.
Jeez, is that all I am?
Marsh thinks he's dead. Drank himself to hell and gone, rigid on a slab, his liver has failed, his skin is slowly getting cold.
Sweet.
Dee almost gets enjoyment from that. Nearly as much enjoyment as he gets from watching his precious Ruby in action, not just here in the diner, but unleashed upon the world.
News at 6. Is everybody going crazy? Reports are coming in from across the state about a wave of madness, suicide, and bad dreams.
Dr. Dee feels pleasure. Hour 9.
Filthy dirt, bitch!
Conflict, he decides, reveals character.
Marsh, honey, please calm down.
Filth! Lesbo! Filth!
Please, she's just a kid.
You bastard! I'll kill you! Let go of me! I'll kill
him! All you need is a proper man. A real man. I'll show you, bitch. I'll give it to you. Yeah.
Dee, 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 we love you.
Hour 10. They love him. He has dispensed with the overcoat and naked is hoisted shoulder high and carried around the diner.
Love you. Dee, 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 we love you. Dee, 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 we love you. Dee, 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 we love you.
You're so beautiful.
Mark uses one of Betty's carving knives to amputate a finger.
I am beautiful.
Dr. D, Dr. D, great and wise and wonderful D.
Dr. D, great and wise and wonderful D.
I am your god.
Mark proffers the severed little finger from his left hand. Dr. D licks the blood from it. A god must not appear ungracious toward a sacrifice. However, he derives no satisfaction from it. He doesn't know what he wants to eat. There must be something.
Dr. D, great and wise and wonderful me!
Hour 11. He catches up on the news.
Nightmares, sleeplessness, and insanity reported earlier on local news is shaping up to be a planet-wide phenomenon. Reports have already come in from Asia and Europe of accidents and disasters from people falling asleep on freeways, planes crashing, heart surgery. Even a full report is very genteel. Very.
Leading fundamentalists have begun to proclaim the Armageddon. Internationally, people can't sleep, or they have nightmares, and anybody even marginally mentally unbalanced is going over the edge. No international superheroes were available for comment, so I spoke to Herschel of local super team, the amazing Herschel and Betty.
Hi. Am I on? Is this working? Okay. Yeah. Well, me and Betty, we figure it's probably rays.
And finally, in Baltimore, a woman claims she's taught her dog to tap dance. More on that after the break.
Hour 12. It is time for them to get to know each other better.
Now, you.
Worst, most shameful thing I've ever done? Oh, gee, I can't tell you. I can't. I was 18. I was at college. I was drunk. To begin with, I was drunk anyway.